Today's Teisho will be on case one in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case one is entitled, Emperor Wu Asks Bodhidharma. Engo's introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance and you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then, whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in giving and in taking. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See Secho's complications. Main subject. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, no holiness. Who is this standing before me? Said the emperor. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, his minister, who said, do you in fact know who that person is? The emperor said, he said his name was Not Knowing. Shiko said, that is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him now. Even if all the people went, he would not turn back. Secho's verse, holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret again? What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing. So I make my living as an English teacher. I teach writing, and sometimes I teach literature classes too. So every day, pretty much, or at least three or four times a week, I have to go into a classroom and encounter my students. And, you know, that's always an interesting situation. Because, you know, sometimes, especially when I was just getting started at this game, I've been doing it since 1977, so a long time. Ever since I started teaching, going into a classroom and encountering my students, I've had anxieties about this situation. You know, I can remember being a new teaching assistant and really wanting to be a good teacher. And I think my first class was an absolute disaster. You know, I think I had planned in my mind, I had planned it out. I knew what I was going to have my students look at, something I had brought in for them to read and discuss. And I had an idea about how the discussion would go and where it would end up. And you know, I brought this piece of material in. These were the days long before there was something called a Xerox machine. There was something called a mimeograph machine. I'm sure some of you have never seen one or heard one. But in the old days, you used to type what you wanted to give to your students on something that looked like carbon paper. Probably most of you don't know what carbon paper is. But it was a piece of paper that had kind of like ink on one side, and then on top of the ink was another piece of paper. And when you would type on this special piece of paper, it would make an image on one side of the paper. Then you would take that paper and you'd put it in, on a cylinder that was filled with a kind of ink. And you'd crank the cylinder and it would reproduce what you typed on clean paper sheets. So you could type your lesson out for the day on this special mimeograph paper. And then you would put it on the cylinder. There was a way to attach it to the cylinder, and you'd crank this cylinder, and you would produce, 25 or 50 copies. And you could save your old mimeographs in a folder, and you could use them for a long time. After a while, they wouldn't work anymore. The image would become fainter and fainter as the impression on the paper would become squashed by overuse. But at any rate, I remember carefully preparing my mimeographs. And by the way, they had a wonderful smell, just beautiful. The ink just smelled so lovely. And so I did my mimeographs, I brought them in, and I had imagined my students would read this material and they would be so engaged and they'd have so many questions. And, I was eager to have a discussion about this, and I gave it to my students, and there was a very minimal response, so I didn't know what to do. I thought this was really going to, light a fuse, and everybody would be excited, and people would be competing for my attention, and it didn't happen. They read it, a couple people commented. And then I was stuck. It's like, I have 40 minutes left. What'll I do, It was a disaster. And I remember coming home and just, not being able to sleep, I couldn't sleep. I was so worried. I developed like a phobia about going into the classroom. So, one of the strategies I developed after having a couple classes like that, I was really traumatized. So I decided, the secret to this is to be a meticulous planner. So I would never go into a classroom without like three or four activities. And so I would always have like an abundance of material, and I would have many, many possibilities, if this didn't work, this might work, and if I ran out of time, I'd pull this out of my briefcase and I could, I could fill up 80 minutes that way, I became like an obsessive planner for a long time. And I found that actually this, at first it was a big relief not to have this empty space in my classroom. But eventually, I began to not enjoy my teaching that much. Because I really wasn't, nothing about it was really spontaneous, I was just bringing in this material and throwing it at my students, and I just kept it coming. And, some of the classes were not very successful, even though they were filled with activities. I didn't get much out of it. I don't think my students got much out of it. So, I've been teaching for a long time, and I've tried many different things. I've noticed, that you can overplan. Actually, maybe I underplanned in those first classes, and it's traumatized me for 30 years. But you can overplan. Sometimes I will come in, and I will have material I want to work on, and the conversation just won't go in the direction I want. And if you overplan, that creates a lot of tension and frustration. You want the conversation to go to the right, And you bring in something for them to discuss, but they don't want to go to the right. Everything seems to be moving to the left, you know. And for a long time, that would cause me a lot of stress. You know, I would be thinking, how am I going to get them back on track? You know? And I went through years like that. But then I began to realize, look, why are they going to the left? You know, what is it? There's something about this that's interesting to them. And, you know, maybe I should see where this is going to go. And when I began to be more spontaneous in that way, you know, I actually enjoyed teaching more. And I learned a lot about my students. You know, I would learn, you know, they would have things to contribute. And I would learn a lot from listening to them. They would have thought about something in a way that I never would have thought, would have considered. I developed this idea that maybe you need to be a little looser in the class. You know, you don't have to have it all planned out. Come in, you know, put something in front of everybody, and then let's see where it goes. You know, so the class becomes kind of like an event. You know, there's not a schedule anymore. We're going to see what emerges from our conversation. You know, and you know, this is risky. You know, some days it really goes well. You know, some days people are really on. And that's really like heaven, right? And then some days people are not so on, you know? And now I still, you know, I sort of have a compromised position. I have other material in my briefcase in case things don't go well, but I also want to be a little spontaneous. And sometimes it just doesn't click. Sometimes things just don't click. But I've been in the classroom so long, I don't begin to panic, you know, that's okay. But it's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes things click and sometimes they don't click. You know, why is that? Why is that? I've had semesters where I have the same class, not back to back, but within, you know, one class period. So I'll come into one class, you know, and I'll start working with the material and I'll crack a joke. And it's like silence, you know, silence. So, you know, then I'll go into the next class, you know, and I'll crack the same joke. Oh, you know, Barry, everybody's laughing, you know. I'll be working with some material and I'll point something out. And, the first class, it's just very little response. And the second class, people are just jumping up and down. You know, it's like perfect. Why is that? You know, why is that? this is about, this story is a very famous story in Zen history. Bodhidharma is the monk who brought Zen, or Chan, to China. He was probably from North India. Although he's often said to be from South India, he was probably from Northern India. And he brought this tradition of Zen to China. And when he came, when he first arrived, he was in his 40s. And he was very highly regarded as a meditation master in India. And he was given an interview with the Emperor of Liang, Emperor Wu of Liang. Now, Buddhism was already well established in China at this time, by this time. So Zen was arriving on the scene rather late. There were already centuries of a cultural exchange between India and China. And there were many different schools of Buddhism represented. And Emperor Wu of Liang was actually quite a patron of Buddhism. So he had spent a lot of money, a lot of his treasury, building like monasteries and temples, stupas or pagodas, research institutes funding translation projects and so on. He was a real patron of the Dharma. When Bodhidharma came to China, there was this, probably somebody who heard about Bodhidharma arranged for him to meet with the emperor. And so this is really like one of the most famous encounters in Zen history, famous stories in Zen history. And it's an interesting story because it's really about, it's like a, it didn't work out. It's like it wasn't a successful meeting. So basically, when the emperor meets Bodhidharma, he says, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" And he's expecting Bodhidharma to say something like compassion, or he's expecting the Bodhidharma to say something like, maybe quote one of the sutras, or talk about Yogacara philosophy, or talk about Madhyamaka concepts of realism or something. And instead, Bodhidharma simply says, emptiness. So he says, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? And Bodhidharma basically says, holy teachings, what are you talking about? Emptiness is what it's all about. See? The emperor is just completely rocked back on his heels. He said, emptiness, not holiness. I thought Buddhism was all about holiness. And then he says, who is this standing in front of me? Who are you? And Bodhidharma doesn't say, I'm Bodhidharma. I come from Nalanda University. I have a PhD in Buddhology, and I'm a distinguished meditator. He says, Who are you standing before me? And Bodhidharma basically, he doesn't even say, I don't know. He says, not knowing. Not knowing. And the emperor, it says, the emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. So this is like if you've ever had a disastrous job interview, this is like a disastrous job interview, bad talk. Sometimes you plan your class so meticulously, and you come into class and you think, okay, this is just going to be, I'm going to knock the ball out of the stands, right? And it's just like nothing goes right. Halfway through, it's like that, you look at your watch and 2 minutes have gone by. Then you look at your watch again and three, it's like interminably slow, You look at their blank faces and they're just like gone, they're not there, right? This is a teacher's world. Sometimes I've given paper, if you're in my business, sometimes you have to go to conferences and give papers. And it's the same thing, You think, oh, this is going to be a great paper. And you start reading, and there's just something in the room, this is not working. It happens, right? You're giving a paper, and you look around, nobody's looking at you with a sad face or looking at you like you're an idiot. But you can just, it's like you sense it in the room. It's like something is not working, right? And then I find when I'm in those situations, it's hard to finish, I just feel like, oh, screw it, But you have to finish, you have to give your paper. And it's just so, it's like running through mud, It's like, wow, this was so hard, Okay. And then it's over and it's like, oh, let me out of here, right, But sometimes, though, it works the other way. This is a kind of the Bodhidharma meeting the emperor situation. It's sort of like this, right? I mean, the emperor wanted to like Bodhidharma. He wanted to be liked by Bodhidharma. And, Bodhidharma, maybe he was hoping the emperor would like him. Who knows, And Bodhidharma was really trying to communicate with the emperor something important. And the emperor wanted to learn, from this great... But it was like, it just didn't click. It just doesn't click. There's something, why does that happen? And as I say, sometimes I will be in a hurry. There's times when, I'm in a hurry. I've got a lot on my plate and there's a conference coming up and I have to do a paper. And I know I've got to get to that thing, and maybe I'll get a little time here and a little time there and get on the plane and I'll be riding it on the plane. And I have had these experiences where I think this is just crap. This is going to be a disaster. And then, give the paper and everybody goes, that was wonderful, right? That was great. This happens, or, sometimes I've written something that I just think is, pretty not very interesting and not, oh, brother, I hope nobody reads this, and then people say, oh, I loved that, and, but what about the other thing I wrote that I thought was good? That wasn't very good, This happens all the time, So this is very important, these kinds of moments, because it's pointing to something about our life, So much of what we do and what we think isn't really, how shall I put it? So much of our life is really below the surface of consciousness. It's below the surface of consciousness. You might have had this experience where you get on a plane and you sit down with somebody and all of a sudden there's this resonance, right? All of a sudden you're like, it's just like, what a fascinating person, maybe, you're thinking, oh brother, I'm sitting next to this person, I just want to be left alone, and then you start talking and all of a sudden you realize, this is interesting, I feel more alive, I'm engaged, I don't know who this person is, but, I'm really enjoying this. And then, the flight might be 4 hours and it's just over like that. And you think, wow, that was so wonderful. Why did that happen? So much of our life is not, so much of our life is not really available to our conscious mind. We sit down on a plane with a total stranger and something happens. There's a kind of unconscious resonance, and actually, there's even been a lot of research on this lately. They find that people really do unconsciously resonate with one another, and they have actually done studies of this where they notice that people who start unconsciously resonating with each other start looking in each other's eyes in a certain way, and you'll start noticing symmetries in the way their bodies move. And people have even done studies, and the brains begin to harmonize. So they start firing in sync. This is all happening. So you can't notice it when you're in this circumstance. But people who do research have, had cameras and watched people interact, and when there's this, there's actually a word for it. It's called positivity resonance. When there's positivity resonance, that's when you get on the plane and you're talking to somebody and suddenly you feel like, oh, this is fascinating. Do you like that? I like that. Did you see that? Oh, I love that movie, right? And, it's not necessarily the content of what you're saying, Maybe the person says, you say, did you like that movie? No, I didn't like it. That doesn't necessarily cause us to stop, There's an unconscious positivity resonance that happens, and it's all below the surface, And I think teaching is like this too, I'm having a conversation with my students, but I think my unconscious is having a conversation with the unconscious of my students. I really believe this. And sometimes it really clicks, something really comes out of us from this deeper place and harmonizes, And some days it happens and some days it doesn't. But, so many people talk about this. Musicians go through this, If you're a musician, and you make your living by performing, it's like being a teacher. If you're a teacher, you pretty much teach... you might teach every day or every other day. You're back in that classroom all the time. It's hard to stay fresh. it's hard to have a good rapport with your students, and sometimes it just doesn't click. You know, musicians are like that too. You know, you have to perform maybe every day, 5 days a week, right? You know, and you get in there, and sometimes you're just, musicians will tell you, sometimes it's just so difficult. You're just going through the motions. And indeed, you know, this is why musicians have fairly high rates of like addictions, you know, because, you know, they get into this place where they're, you know, it's all just very mechanical and rather boring, you know. But then they will tell you, you know, sometimes they sit down and it just, everything falls into place. It's like magic. It's like magic. And I think that what happens is that there's this unconscious stirring. And maybe there's an unconscious resonance with the audience, you know, or with the other members of the band. But suddenly the things are knit together. And there's this energy and this power to things that are happening. And this can even happen, you know, when we're alone, you know. So I remember reading something. One of the composers I really like is one of my favorite composers is Aaron Copland. I just love his work. And I was reading something about his composing process, and he said the same thing. He said, you know, he sits down, nothing. You know, he sits down, nothing. And he said, then all of a sudden he just can't stop, and he'll compose. He said he would compose for hours on end. And he said, then it would be gone. He said it would be like somebody turned off the tap, you know. And he said, I know one thing, I'm not doing this, you know. So I think this deeper mind was, you know, suddenly opened up and is producing all this beautiful music, you know. And maybe after 4 or 5 hours, the tap gets closed off, you know. So it's really quite important to realize that, you know, or to think about the possibility that maybe, you know, the lives we live, our conscious lives, are really not our whole life. That the consciousness is really like a wave on the ocean, or the tip of the iceberg. And that so much of what happens in our lives is below the surface. You know, when we look at our lives superficially, you know, we think about just our conscious lives. You know, that's a very false image of what's really happening. Basically, if you could include in your life, you know, we're not always sensitive to what's happening under the surface, but there's so much more going on. You know, I mean, even in things like, things like marriage, you know. You know, nobody really makes a rational decision about who they're going to live their life with. You know, nobody makes a checklist, you know. Somehow you suddenly become obsessed with somebody, and you can't not be around them. And you wake up and they're the first thing you're thinking about, and so on. This is all like unconscious stirring. So, I think modern people, people in our world, are, you know, pretty shallow. They're pretty indifferent to this deeper dimension of our lives. You know, we go through school, and all we ever study is the tip of the iceberg world. You know, all we ever study is like the surface world of consciousness. So, you know, we go through 12 years of schooling where we learn how to do multiplication, or we don't learn, you know, in some cases, and we learn how to write papers and so on and so on. But, you know, we don't really have like we don't know how to educate our unconscious, educate the unconscious. And so, you know, we've created sort of lopsided, massively lopsided human beings where we're very, very well developed intellectually, but we're actually very ignorant of ourselves, and we're very ignorant about how to live life, you know. So, you know, one way to think about Zen is that this is about educating the ourselves, or how shall I put it, educating the unconscious. Or maybe another way to put it is letting the unconscious educate us. Right? Letting the unconscious educate us. So, you know, when Bodhidharma meets Emperor Wu of Liang, you know, Emperor Wu is pretty much living in a world of ideas. You know, he's thinking that something is really gained by studying all these Buddhist sutras. You know, and he thinks that he's accumulating knowledge that will, like, save him from ignorance. Yeah? It's funny, you know, in Zen temple, you know, all Buddhist temples are required to read the canon of Buddhist texts once a year. This is like a passed down from ancient India. And so, you know, basically the theory is that all the monks, or at least some of them, should be going through the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, and so on every year, just to make sure, you know. In Zen temples, you know, they have a ceremony. There's a day where they bring out all the sutras, and basically they just hold the book up and they just go through the pages very quickly. You know, so they take out the sutra book and then they just thumb through the pages, and they do it once for each book, and then they put them back on the shelf. They really do read the sutras. But there's a message there which is saying, you know, it's not the content of this that's liberating. It's not the content. You know, maybe you've had this experience of having a deep conviction that you changed over time. You know, so when I was about 15, I remember reading, believe it or not, I was 15 and I read the Communist Manifesto. And I was thrilled by the Communist Manifesto. And I actually would go to high school and tell everybody I was a communist. Which was a very daring thing to do, actually. Everybody would just go, oh, no, you're not, you know. But for a while, it really seemed to explain everything, you know. But then after a while, it was kind of boring, you know. I got into other things, you know. But, you know, at the time, if I was arguing with somebody, I would argue with such deep conviction, you know. And then later, I didn't care about these ideas at all. And I work in an English department, you know, and people have, like, deep commitments, you know. So I might meet somebody in my department, you know, and have a discussion with them, and it might get very heated, you know. No, that's not right, you know, and people can get very upset. You know, and then you might meet them 5 years later and say, well, are you still studying so-and-so? And they say, oh, no, that's passé, right? You know, they were ready to punch you in the nose 5 years ago, right? But now they don't even care. You know? This is very important. You know, here's another example. You know, I like poetry. So, you know, I have books of poetry. Sometimes I'll pick up a book of poetry and open it up, and there's a poem I tried to read like 3 years ago, and it was just boring. And suddenly I'll read the poem, and I want to cry. It's so beautiful. See, this is all unconscious. It's not the content of our ideas that really matters. It's the deeper experience. At a certain moment in your life, a certain movie or a certain story could move you to tears because it has this unconscious resonance. And at another moment in your life, it might seem trivial and unimportant, you know. It's not the content of the ideas that matters. It's not the content, it's this deeper dimension, you know. Emperor Wu of Liang is living in a world of concepts and ideas, and he thinks that they're liberating. And Bodhidharma is trying to point out to him that you have to have access to this deeper part of yourself if you really want to be liberated. You know, that basically that part of your mind is important, but it's not going to really liberate you, you know. Emperor Wu is just not ready for this, right? He's not ready, and they don't have, you could say, they don't have positivity resonance, you know. So Bodhidharma goes up into the mountains and finds a cave near modern-day Shaolin Temple and lives in a cave for 9 years waiting for his students, for students to show up, right? Now, this is so important because Bodhidharma is a different kind of person. You know, he doesn't just live on the surface. He knows how to get access to this deeper part of ourselves. And he tells the emperor how to get access to it. You know, when we do our zazen, when we sit down on the cushion, you straighten the back and you begin to breathe from the hara, the dantian, you squeeze the breath out and you release. You know, it isn't very long before you enter like an altered state of consciousness, actually. You know, your normal consciousness is, you know, I have to get groceries at the store, I've got to get that talk ready for, you know, 2 weeks from now, I've got to grade my papers, whatever, you know. And you're thinking, you know, very much a self-centered thinking in terms of all these issues and projects of the self. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and begin to watch your breath, people don't normally notice this, but you start moving into a different state of consciousness. And you know, if you keep watching the breath, you know, eventually your self-awareness disappears, and you begin to have a kind of awareness without a subject. It's just like a kind of ambient consciousness without subject, or this, your sense of self is here sometimes and it's gone. You know, it's here and it's gone. This is actually, even though people might not appreciate it, very different from ordinary everyday consciousness where the self is often very much at the center. So, you know, we get into this, we call it a samadhi state, where the self is sort of at the margin and you're much more absorbed by what's happening from one moment to the next, you know. And if you keep watching the breath, you'll eventually notice that your mind goes to a place, often as you're following the breath out, the mind goes to a place that's like blank and dark. And in Zen, we call this mu, which means shunyata in Sanskrit, zeroness. Now, you know, within the Buddhist community, actually, there's a big debate about the status of zeroness. You know, the Dalai Lama's tradition, which is called Madhyamaka, the Madhyamaka tradition, doesn't necessarily believe that emptiness is a real thing. But we Zen people believe that emptiness is real, that it really exists. You know, and that it's not relative, it's absolutely present. When you are in deep meditative concentration, we encounter this blankness, this vast emptiness, as Bodhidharma says. Now, these traditions, these different traditions, the Bodhidharma, the Dalai Lama's tradition, our tradition, all have the same goal, so it doesn't matter. This is like hair splitting, because actually they also value emptiness. But our Zen practice really is centered around the experience of emptiness. Because emptiness is, you could say, when your mind is empty, you are looking at your unconscious mind. It's like going right up to the door of your unconscious mind. And the conscious mind, the mind that thinks, goes up to the door of that emptiness, and it might find it boring, it might find it annoying, it might find it threatening, and it's waiting for some kind of ideas to appear, or concepts or something, and sometimes we create concepts, you know, in the presence of that emptiness. But you know, Zen, the Zen idea is that you'll never be able to see beyond that blankness with your discriminating mind. You have to feel beyond that blankness. So the intellectual mind, the thinking mind, can only go so far. It gets to that blank place and then it's stopped, it's arrested. You know, and the koans do this to us again and again. They arrest us at this blankness. And then you have to act from a different place. You have to develop a kind of, you could say, in Zen we call it the trusting mind. Doesn't mean the discriminating mind, it's the trusting mind. We say the great way is one with the trusting mind. See? And so we're waiting for something to come out of this blankness that's going to maybe solve our problem or help us with an emergency. Or deepen our life, you know. So, you know, the Western view of the unconscious is not the same as the Buddhist view, the Zen view of the unconscious, because, you know, I think Freud was a really great person, and he was a great thinker, but he tends to think of the unconscious as a somewhat of a scary place, right? Sort of dangerous and a little bit scary. But the Buddhist view of the unconscious is very different. You know, there are things in our unconscious mind which are like traumas and, you know, things we haven't dealt with. That's true. But at the core of the unconscious, in the Buddhist view, is this enlightened mind, fundamental compassion, and you could say boundless compassion. This is it. So. At the core of the unconscious is like this boundless compassion, and in Sanskrit the word for this is a very complicated word that you don't have to remember. It's called tathagata garbha. That's probably not that memorable, but it means it actually means womb of the Buddhas. So at the core of our consciousness is this boundless compassion. In Zen we don't call it Tathagata Garbha, we call it Buddha nature. But basically Zen is all about learning how to trust your Tathagata Garbha, learning how to trust. The Zen view is that at the core of yourself there is this compassionate intelligence that actually is trying to protect you and guide you all the time. Really, that's what we believe. And the big mind, as we call it, this big mind is trying to protect and nourish us and guard us and help us and make us happy and complete and connected. But our little mind is always fighting it, right? You know? Our destiny, so to speak, is to become like enlightened beings. That's the Buddhist view. The Buddhist view is that sooner or later everybody is going... It's like people say Buddhism is pessimistic, but it's not. It's like wildly optimistic. You know, the Buddhist teaching is everybody's going to wake up sooner or later. It may take a long time, but everybody's going to wake up. And everything in your life, from the Buddhist standpoint, is helping you wake up. That seems wildly optimistic, but that's the view. So, you know, human beings are like little acorns that are going to grow into oak trees. But they're neurotic little acorns. You know? So the whole time, you know, they're going, oh my God, you know, I'm falling out of the tree, you know? Now I'm on the ground. You know, oh my God, I'm on the ground, I'm helpless, you know. Now I'm sinking into the ground. This is terrible, you know. Now I'm cracking open. What's happening to me? This is terrible, you know. Now I'm changing form, you know, I'm becoming long. Oh, you know. But of course all this time they're growing into this majestic oak tree. So this is this is the Buddhist view of our relationship, the conscious and the unconscious mind. See, so So, you know, we're constantly worried, right? The little mind is constantly worried. It's trying to figure it out. It's trying to protect itself. It's like that little acorn, you know, terrified of these changes it can't understand, which are leading it to fulfill its destiny and be an enlightened being. And most of us, you know, most of us just can't trust that process. We just can't, you know. And I myself, you know, I have to do a lot of zazen because this is like, you know, we sit down and you do some, this is like trust work, you know. You sit down on the cushion and you learn how to trust all over again. And you don't trust, you don't trust, you don't trust, and then somehow a door opens up inside yourself and, well, that was the darndest thing, you know, it all turned out okay. You know, so you know, basically we're struggling with our fears and our attachments, and our unconscious mind, the Buddhist view is the unconscious mind is dragging us towards enlightenment. So you know, Bodhidharma is our exemplar of this kind of trusting relationship to the world. So, you know, he leaves India in his mid-40s to bring a Buddhism, his version of Buddhism, to China. And he has, you know, it starts out well. He has an interview with the emperor, you know, so it could have gone really beautifully, you know. He could have said a few things to the emperor. The emperor would say, oh my God, we've got to build you a temple right away. You know, it's going to be great, you know, and we'll have the Zen Studies Institute here in Beijing, you know. And, but it doesn't happen. You know, it's this disastrous interview. It's like one of those job interviews. It's just this disaster, right? One of those talks you give, and it's like, oh, let me out of here. You know, Bodhidharma, if he were a different kind of person, would be crushed. He'd go, I'm going back to India. This is not working out. Instead, he does something totally, from the standpoint of the discriminating mind, totally crazy, right? He goes up to this cave and sits in a cave. And if anybody comes up to, you know, maybe the townspeople brought in food and things, and they say, what are you, you know, you're some old monk living up here. What are you doing? I'm waiting for students to show up. It's like, good luck with that, right? You know, if this were America, he'd be on the talk circuit. You know, he'd have a book. He'd be, you know, Leonard Lopate would be interviewing him on WNYC. And would, well, tell us, Bodhidharma, you know, what is this Zen anyway? You know. But anyway, he's in a cave, right? And he's sitting there for 9 years doing his zazen, facing blankness. Sitting in front of that blankness in Zen is called pikwan, wall staring. If you hear people in Zen talk about pikwan, they're not. It doesn't mean you're looking. You're sitting next to a literal wall. You can sit next to a wall, facing a wall, but that's not pikwan. Pikwan is facing that emptiness. And he sits there. That and wouldn't you know, students show up. You know, two men and a woman came and became Bodhidharma students, and that was the beginning of Zen in China. And Zen eventually became the dominant form of Buddhism in China, the most important Buddhism in China. So you know, Bodhidharma represents for us a kind of way of living in the unconscious, trusting the unconscious mind. We say trusting the big mind. And he had many occasions to be doubtful and fearful, and maybe he was, you know, but he got up every day and he did his zazen. And, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath or you enter that blankness, you know, you get off the cushion and it's a different world. It really cracks open all the staleness. You know, the job of the discriminating mind is to create enduring structures that are absolutely reliable, but we become prisoners of those. You know, and everything becomes stale and very unlifelike. You know, so we sit down on the cushion and sweep away all of our preconceptions, and then, you know, somebody serves us a date or a cup of tea, and it's like heaven, you know. How come it's so good? It's because it's that deep resonance. Now you're coming at the experience from a different place. It's like the whole being is now eating the date, not just your head, you know. You're not just eating from your head, you're eating from the whole being. the whole array of your senses, your unconscious. No wonder the date is so good. No wonder the tea is so delicious. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness, no holiness." "Who is this standing before me?" said the emperor. "I, not knowing," said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, his minister, who said, "Do you in fact know who this person is?" The emperor said, "He said his name was not knowing." Shiko said, "That is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal." The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, "It's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return." Secho's verse, the holy teaching, vast emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing.